Houston Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey.
Doesn't the weather change your attitude about everything? I'm serious about that, doesn't it?
You want to give Rhapsody now about tulips in the public garden gym?
No, I didn't want to wax on. No, I was not going to wax about anything. I'm just saying that when the weather is beautiful like this, you feel good about things you might not otherwise feel good about, like me, for example.
Forget that. Well, Jim.
Okay,
that's
fine.
Well.
It's time for politics. Joining us in studio, and they're feeling quite upbeat too, is Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies. We're also Hey, Charlie. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Good. You feeling great because of the weather too?
My wife's a gardener. I have to feel good when the weather's like this.
Excellent. Good. No. We're also joined by Dori Clark of Clark Strategic Communications. Dori has a new book out. It's called Reinventing You. We'll find out in a minute what it means. Define your brand. Imagine your future. Good to see you, Dori.
Jim, thanks for having me.
God, that's a great title. I think we could all use a little reinvention, don't you think, about this stage of the game? So what do you think, you guys? We'll start with you, Dori. I mean, this race between Markey and Gomez, we're talking 44% for Markey, 40% for Gomez. It's really rather tight so soon after the primary.
I think it's illusory.
You do?
I do. If you look at it a little further into the numbers, you have well over 30% that have no opinion whatsoever of Gomez. I think that Markey is going to be taking the next month and just hammering him, and he's going to drive up the negatives, and we're going to start to see a gap.
Do you think 2-1 independence for Gomez is illusory, too? That's a pretty big number, and they decide elections in this state.
It's true, but we also have to keep in mind this is a special election. You have to be incredibly motivated to turn yourself out to remember to do that in the summer. And I'm just skeptical that there's going to be a broad enough turnout from independents to make it happen.
Well, you know, Markey already has a 40% negativity rating, which is pretty high. So what do you think, Charlie Chipio?
Well,
I mean, how much higher can Markey drive Gomez? Can you get over to 60%? I don't know.
Well, you know, I have to say that I think that on this one, Dori may actually be right, because as much as I... You know, to me, Ed Markey is the face of Tammany Hall, you know, and he's
we all remember Tammany Hall quite well.
But, you know, this whole thing, two things about Gomez are disturbing. One, you know, is this whole thing where he was part of this group that was going after Obama for you know, making political hay on Osama bin Laden, which I didn't think Obama did any more than any other politician. And then, you know, going, trying to get this Senate appointment, telling Governor Patrick that he was going to support Obama and all these things. I mean, I don't know. That just seems sort of odd.
Well, let me argue against him on both things. One, while it didn't help, most people thought it would not help him in the primary to be asking Obama for anything and to be praising Deval Patrick in that letter. It seems to me in a final, if you own it a little bit more, it helps you. And two, I think the person who comes out on the short end of that whole Obama-Osama thing is actually Markey. The ad, the first ad up on the web, for those who haven't seen it, we're going to play it, but it's mostly visual, is an image of Osama bin Laden side by side with Gabriel Gomez. And even if he made a mistake, and I agree with you, he did, being a spokesperson for this group that says the president politicized the capture of bin Laden, that's taken it too far. You don't think that when a voter in the state, an independent, sees a picture of Gomez next to bin Laden, they're going to say, are you kidding me?
Well, I hope that's true, but I have my doubts. And I do think that if that happened in isolation, it would be one thing. I think the question is, are voters going to put together this combination of that and the fact that he was, on the other hand, asking for this position?
You're a conservative that feels he isn't the true conservative. Isn't that the bottom line? I mean, really? Yeah.
No, I'm pro-choice, pro-gay rights. I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm certainly not
I meant fiscally conservative, but you don't think he's the real deal, right?
No, I really don't have a problem with him on the issues. My fear is simply that he's going to come across as a guy who's not ready for prime time.
Well, by the way, we should play for you. We told you we couldn't really play the Osama Obama ad with Gomez's face in there because it was mostly visual. Here is the first web ad from Gabriel Gomez, which to me shows exactly what this campaign is going to be about. Here's an excerpt.
If you're looking for a rigid partisan, I'm not your guy. If you're looking for someone who won't reach across the aisle, if you're looking for someone who refuses to work with the other party, and if you're looking for an experienced, slick-talking politician, I'm definitely not your guy.
You know, Dory was clear from their acceptance speeches, and that was from his acceptance speech. Markey, in 6 seconds, was eviscerating Gomez on the issues. Gomez was talking about how great his family was, how great kids are. I mean, that is what the next 50-some days are going to be, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, ultimately, you've got a Democratic Party that is completely scarred by the Coakley versus Brown experience. They felt like, you know, correctly, that they were asleep at the wheel, and they now need to do everything possible to prevent that from happening. And by everything possible, we mean a nuclear attack on Gabriel Gomez.
But I think the other side of that is the result of that is that you have a Republican Party that is rightfully completely scarred by the fact that, you know, Suzanne Bump could beat Mary Connaughton and Tierney could beat Tissé. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think a special election's the only chance you have.
With illegal offshore gambling rings, Charlie. There's nothing wrong with those.
What am I thinking? I know.
That was, of course, associated with Tierney's brother-in-law.
In this discussion, I feel like I'm Gabriel Gomez's campaign manager.
Well, hold on.
But, you know, I got to
tell you. Let me be Gabriel Gomez's campaign manager for a second. I think that ad, when you see that ad by Ed Markey, it gives you the creeps. He's got the, and people should watch it because the visuals are fantastic. But then you have that awful music, you know, that Gabriel Gomez is basically a predator and a serial killer is the message you're getting from Markey. And, you know, Charlie's being the face of Tammany Hall. I'm going to steal my colleague Peter Galzinis' line and say Markey looks like he belongs on the set of Downton Abbey. You know, you just have a little change the outfit a little bit. And there he is. And he's got this way of speaking. I mean, he's very impressive when you ask him about his record because he can just hammer off all those.
He really knows the issues.
But there's a sort of John Kerryan way he has of delivering those, a little Louisburg Square that, you know, I think some independents may say enough of this stuff.
Louisburg Square by way of Malden.
Yeah, but exactly. By way of, well, he hasn't been in Malden that much a long time. So I don't know. I think that Gomez has got a better chance than you guys do. But go ahead.
No, than they do. I mean, I said to Marjorie knows this. I think I said on the air here, a key Democratic consultant in town texted me right after the Gomez victory and said, Latino, Navy SEAL, entrepreneur, even though he's got to answer a lot of questions about his business background that he is not answering. I think that's going to be a major part of this campaign, his 9 years at Advent International. I mean, essentially is what the national GOP says they want to be to get out of this mess they found themselves in with a 71-29 margin with Latinos
basically
for Obama
Marco
overrun.
Rubio.
No, really. Well, I would say Rubio and then a little bit better. You had the Navy SEAL deal, and he says he's totally with Rubio on immigration. Now, the one issue that I'm not sure has the legs that Ed Markey thinks it has in this race, Charlie Chipio, starting with you, Markey said repeatedly, including to me, and he said on the show, he's going to raise this People's Pledge thing every day, the notion that they should pledge to keep outside money, you know, these third-party super PAC things out. The Koch brothers, as Markey said on election night, the car roves, etc. And I think he said he was going to be waiting at the Parker House today for Gomez, who's probably not going to show up to sign this. And what I think the one smart thing Markey has done is every time he mentions it, he says, just like the one that Scott Brown signed in the race against Martha Coakley, probably the only time he ever praised Scott Brown. Does that have legs? Does the average voter care about where the money – I think they should, but they don't. Do they?
Here's what I don't think they will in this case, and here's why that bothers me so much. One, I wonder if his nose is growing every time he makes this claim. And the second thing is, the one thing, you know, for Ed Markey or any, like, entrenched Massachusetts Democrat to make this claim is so insane, because here's the one fact you need to know that tells you all you need to know about Massachusetts politics. 17 out of the 20 political action committees that give the most to Massachusetts politicians are labor organizations. So what are you going to do? I mean, you have this gigantic, unstoppable money, power, you know, machine. And look, you got to have some way to fight against it. You know, I don't think Markey is saying anything about how much money he's going to pull in from labor. You know,
and also, he gets money as well from Planned Parenthood. I don't know how much he gets, but he must get a certain amount of money.
Yeah, but the difference is, I asked him about this, is a big his argument, which I find to be meritorious, unlike you, Charlie. The problem is, I don't think the voters care. Is he said his primary concern is not just that all this out-of-state money's coming in, but with these super PACs, you have no idea who's given the money. If you get money from Planned Parenthood or the Service Employees International, you have to say, I got it from the union. I got it from this pro-choice organization. That's the issue. But do you think this works for Markey, or do you not, Dory Clark?
I don't. I think that ultimately these sort of, you know, technical good government issues are, you know, on the checklist of the Cantabrigian voters that you know so well, Jim, but it doesn't
play. I being
play.
One of them,
of course. Well, that's right. And I think that's particularly true in a low turnout special election where you only have a month and a half to campaign.
Yeah.
You think this thing is going to be low turnout? I mean, nobody cared about the primaries at all. It was pretty evident.
Yeah.
But you don't think that, assuming that there's national Republican money sent into this, you don't think this profile, this thing, you're shaking your head, Dory, no? You don't think the profile is going to explode? I do.
I think actually, I mean, Scott Brown in his initial election had several things. Number one, Ted Kennedy was such an icon. Everyone wanted to see who would succeed him. Number two, we were right in the midst of Obamacare, and Scott Brown was able to say, look, I am going to be the 41st vote. It had national import. This is interesting, and it is an important race, but it's not that important.
Yeah, I think it'll be a big deal to, you know, a lot of the pundits, but I'm not sure it'll be a big deal in terms of big turnout here.
Although, you know, on the superficial level, which we're never supposed to mention, but it is really
never.
True, the fact that Gomez is such a good-looking guy, that is going to attract people that may not be otherwise
and a
interested.
And all that sort
yes,
of
Yes, because you see the guy, and you see the Navy SEAL, and whether he's in his olive flight jacket or his leather bomber jacket that he wore in here or something, that is going to attract maybe the disinterested voter.
Okay, let me claim credit for something from our former radio life. I think we deserve credit for this, even though probably a million other people came up with it. Prior to Elizabeth Warren hitting on Scott Brown, we don't know about that, but hitting on Scott Brown with the whole notion that if you vote for Scott Brown, you're voting for a vote for Mitch McConnell and all these horrible Republican chairs, et cetera. Obviously, it's not an issue here because it's a special election. The Democrats have enough of a majority. Here's what and she ultimately embraced that big time. I think an issue here, Dory Clark, is this. And I asked Ed Markey about this the other night on television. He had a great answer, which I'll tell you in a second. We have had only one constitutional officer, a Republican, in more than a decade, statewide constitution. That was Mitt Romney. Only one person representing us in Washington. That was Scott Brown. If you say to the voters, hey, do you want 5 out of 5 Democrats statewide office? Do you want 11 out of 11 people representing you in the House and the Senate, all Democratic? Don't you want one Republican voice? Don't you think that to the fence sitter who's not either in love with Gomez or Markey, don't you think that pushes the fence sitter towards Gomez? It would. I think it does.
Well, I think that it's a powerful argument. And, you know, it's an argument that even to me as a registered Democrat is appealing. I mean, I like the idea of it. That being said, the National Republican Party has gotten so extreme. I mean, this is the line that that John Kerry used in 96 against Bill Weld, to vote for Bill Weld, just vote for Trent Lott. And people look at that and they say, wow, that's actually really scary. And I think that it cuts both ways.
How about you, Charlie Chipio? I love the argument.
I think it is a good argument. But, you know, Scott Brown used it, too, and it didn't work for him. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a little bit better chance that it might work here simply because it will be a lower turnout.
And you know what's going to be, I think, crucial, assuming anybody watches them, and we know they didn't watch them last time around the debates.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be how much can Markey pick on the Navy SEAL with his, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of every legislative bill that's passed since 1957 or something? And or will Gomez, the other side, look like he's out of his league? I mean, we just don't know.
Do you think Gomez will at any time during the debates actually wink at the camera? I think that – do you think – because that's where Marjorie seems to be going. That would be a bit much.
I think he's going to wink at Marjorie.
He may do that. Charlie, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
I forgot what I was going to say.
Good.
No
sure
idea.
Good. Let's talk guns a little bit. As the arguments are getting sort of front burnered again, Gabby Gifford's got the Profile and Courage Award yesterday. The NRA is having its convention. And on the other side, people like Jeff Flake in Arizona admits he's pond scum because he voted against the Manchin-Toomey compromise, and Kelly Ayotte's having problems too.
She's having problems too, of course, because she voted against the background checks as well. We're going to hear a sound in a second from a gentleman that was at the NRA convention, but he makes the point perfectly that I read somewhere this weekend where the NRA used to represent gun owners, now it represents gun makers. It used to represent sportsmen, and now it represents survivalists. Here's one of those survivalists. His name is T.J. Scott at the NRA convention.
As far as I'm concerned, if you can afford to buy a tank, you should be able to buy a tank. See, my belief is that the Second Amendment was put in not to hunt, not to go plink at cans, not to shoot at targets. If and when tyranny tries to take over our country, we can fight it.
So there he is. He's going to fight back when tyranny takes over the country. He's, a survivalist or something. I mean, what do you make? I didn't really pay that much attention to the NRA until the last couple of years. Now I've become obsessed with what a bunch of lunatics, at least the leadership of the NRA, is. What do you think, Dory?
Well, I think that the rightward lurch is really alarming. I mean, I was the New Hampshire communications director for Howard Dean when he ran for president.
Yes.
And, you know, here's somebody that, at least in the popular imagination, is about as left as you can get. And meanwhile, he was endorsed six times by the NRA when he ran for governor. The NRA was a different organization then. It has changed. They have essentially become gun fundamentalists.
Yeah, but they're winning the debate. You know, everybody, at least in Massachusetts, not everybody, the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats like to distance themselves from the NRA, but they're winning the debate in Washington,
well,
Charlie.
Look, there's no doubt about that. I mean, we all need a passport to go to America. There's no doubt about that from here. But you know, they're winning the debate right now. But I wonder, you know, what are the reports? Kelly Ayotte fell 11 points after
great.
This vote.
I love
favorability,
it.
You know, this stuff is really resonating. I think that from here, the NRA's influence can only go down, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
And you know what else is exciting? We've got Bloomberg raising all this money to fight the NRA. We've got Gabby Giffords now. They've started this Americans for Responsible Solutions website where they're trying to raise money. It's a pack to raise money. You get the Newtown parents, who I've said before, are really impressive and I hope relentless. And I think it's all about cash.
Yep.
I mean, if these people can begin to get close to what the NRA spends, which is up in the teens of millions on Republicans, I think, last year, but still... If
and
they
then,
can raise
then
some
gonna,
money,
you're
going
to see this Aurora trial going forward, which I think they could also use to raise more money. So.
Yeah, and you also, horribly, these shootings continue to happen.
Yeah, yeah, we mentioned that. You mentioned Gabby Giffords. Can we just take a second? She received the Profile and Courage Award from Caroline Kennedy yesterday. Here's a little piece of what Giffords had to say.
We all have courage inside. I wish there was more courage in Congress. Sometimes it's hard to express it. I know. It's been a hard 2 years for me, but I want to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if anybody deserves a Profile and Courage Award, it's her. Mm-hmm. One of the most poignant and painful stories I've heard, I mentioned Jeff Flake, and for those who don't know, he's a Republican senator from Arizona who used to be very close friends with Gabby Giffords.
Yeah.
And he, to his credit, he voted against the Manchin-Toomey moderate expansion of the background check thing that didn't get the necessary 60 votes a couple of weeks ago in the same week as the marathon bombing in the United States Senate. He mentions they're very close friends. He mentions that Gabby Giffords went to lobby him and then he couldn't even look at her. And I'm paraphrasing what he said on his face, but it was really incredibly painful. But the guy is self-aware enough. The term I used before, where he said I'm pond scum, were his own words on his Facebook page, because even in Arizona, which is not exactly Massachusetts, the overwhelming majority of people want this. And the thing I don't get, you're both involved in strategy. And starting with you, Dory, it seems to me if I was head of the NRA, which I don't think will be happening terribly soon, what I would have done is I would have embraced a limited background check thing. And for the next 30 years, when I opposed every other gun reform, I'd say, what are you talking about? We embraced the background check compromise in 2013, as opposed to being seen as so far out of the mainstream. Why don't they do that? I don't get it.
Well, I think that what you're talking about, Jim, would be smart politically, and that's what I would advise them to do if I was consulting for them. That being said, I mean, I really think that it's a question of ideologies. It reminds me, interestingly, of the Catholic Church. It reminds me of Pope Benedict, where he said, you know what? We are going to drill down into what I believe is the core of our mission and our ethos. And if other people don't like it, that's fine. We're going to be small and we're going to be pure. And I think that that's what the NRA is doing.
Yeah, but I think as they begin to look more and more like the John Birch Society, then when you have your own membership saying we don't disagree with leadership, and when you have up in New Hampshire, this is what I don't get about Kelly Ayotte. I understand why someone like the guy, is it Montana, Missouri, the guy that says his voters are, his constituents are very against background checks.
Is this Baucus
and
maybe in Montana?
But
Democrat, by the way.
He's also retiring.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very good point.
Ayotte is in a much different place. New Hampshire voters want background checks.
Right.
So what the heck is up with her, Charlie Chipio?
Well, you know, look, I mean, it's the same question as you could raise about the Tea Party. You know, I mean, if the Tea Party would show some bit of sanity, you know, they might be around 6 or 8 years from now. And I'm convinced that they will be a memory 6 or 8 years from now because of their absolute rigid, ideology, which is so out of line with any.
When you say rigidity and ideology, and both of you have mentioned it, I'm trying to think, who is not rigid enough? And the answer is Obama in the last couple of days floated yet another compromise on Medicare. He's getting savaged by his liberal colleagues in Congress are, how dare you move on this thing? But when you think about it, who in Congress, well, I guess the Gang of Eight to a point on immigration, yep, at least for a limited period of time, was trying to do some compromise. Speaking of the President of the United States, now, Charles, you said you're a fiscal conservative. Are you willing to admit that last week's unemployment numbers on Friday were at least some good news for the summer? Yes?
Yeah, sure.
7.5% unemployment rate. They upped some of the employment numbers from the prior couple of months. So where does that lead people? I assume that means that businesses get more confident. The stock market was at 15,000 for a couple of minutes last week. What does that mean going forward, in terms of investment and those kind of things?
There's a couple of things. One, certainly the stock market was good news. The problem is, of course, that, you know, anybody who looks at these numbers know that they're a little bit of a mirage, that, you know, it's still up above 15% when you're talking about all the people who've dropped out and everything. So what I would say is that it's moving in the right direction. It was good news. But, boy, we got a long way to go before everybody's going to start investing in this economy and pouring money in again.
But mindset is so much a part of this thing.
Absolutely.
When you hear business guys and women on Friday and on Saturday saying good things, even those who are not fans of Barack Obama, it's contagious. For those of us who are not economically strong, I mean, in terms of understanding the economy, it is contagious and it does trickle down to consumers, doesn't it?
I think that that's true up to a point, but I agree with Charlie. I think that the numbers don't have a lot backing them up. The soonest sign of some negative news, people are going to feel gobsmacked, and then it's going to go back. I mean, we've been in a period of economic stasis for so long. It's nice to celebrate these small milestones, but we are not out of the woods.
Yeah, then you go online, you get flashed all these pop-ups by these lunatics that are predicting that we're all going to be, you know, we're going to lose everything in about 6 months. And you think, gee, maybe they know something.
It's not even just lunatics.
I mean, do I buy gold? Or, well,
David Stockman.
That's right. He's basically saying the same thing. And he was with Reagan for all those years. And he was the Office of Budget, whatever it was.
He was the supply-side economics.
Yeah, supply-side
economics. Now, speaking of the opposite of supply-side economics, we really didn't want to talk about the economy, Charlie. We wanted to use that as an entry point to talk about Professor Ferguson.
Oh, my God.
From Harvard. We are on this show, we are huge believers in sincere apologies. A week ago Tuesday, John King was on the show, and I think it was the first non-CNN show in which he talked about some of his script. We both are huge fans of John's. Yeah. John gave the most profound, I thought honest, and Marjorie did too, sincere apology for both of the things for which he's taken heat. Now, after this Ferguson character, his professor at Harvard, after saying that Keynes didn't care about future generations because he was gay and had no kids, he subsequently said in his apology that despite having no children, you can still care about future generations. I have to say, and I am generally a second chance kind of guy, I don't understand why this guy is still employed. It's not like he made a bad joke, right, for which you say, oh, my God, I can't believe I made a joke about this big guy being gay and having no kids. He said this in a serious way. He got huge blowback. So now he's doing this pathetic apology. What does it say about Harvard that this guy is still employed on the Monday?
Well, it's Harvard's like every other university. It's calcified and ossified. And, you know, you have to shoot somebody to get fired. I mean, but, you know, look, I mean, it's unbelievable. And all I could think when I heard him say it was that there are a lot of people out there who just want to make headlines, and they think it's good for their career to make headlines, and that's all I can think. And then I was also, frankly, appalled by the apology, because he makes a point of throwing in there, well, it was not part of my prepared remarks. Well, like, that makes it okay?
that's even worse, one would argue, right?
Well, exactly. So, you know, it's just totally...
Okay, Dory, do we can him or no?
You know, I don't actually think it's that big of a deal, honestly.
You don't?
No, I don't. And I say this as a gay person. It's like he was trying to make an argument. He was trying to trash Keynesianism, and he just started doing ridiculous things and pulling in ad hominem attacks and saying, well, and besides, he didn't care about the future. I mean, it was really stupid, and I'm sure that 5 minutes after he got off the stage, he realized, oh, well, you know, all the, you know, 500 gay people I know at Harvard, you know, that's probably a bad move. I think it was insensitive, but should he be fired? Certainly not.
Well, you're not working for him, are you? You're not doing strategic planning for this guy.
I would like to point out, for the record, that according to Mrs. Kane's biographer, he was bisexual, and they had a wonderful marriage. In their letters, they talk about she refers to his slender, subtle fingers, her foxy lips, and their vivid fluctuations.
No, is this true?
In bed. This is written by her biographer.
Well,
yes.
There you go.
And apparently, the reason they couldn't have any children is because he was a chain smoker and he was too old. by the time they were trying.
Well, and so. I just want to say that anybody who has kids knows that you don't have time to think more than 15 minutes ahead, never mind think of future generations.
Exactly.
Hey, Dory, before you guys go, you have this book. I think it's, you have a book party this week or something, Reinventing You, Define Your Brand, Imagine Your Future. What does that mean in English? What is it?
It means that with all of the changes in our crazy economy, every person is going to have to reinvent themselves professionally over the course of their career, whether it means changing jobs or repositioning themselves so that people understand what you're really capable of. And so Reinventing You is a manual for how to do it.
Wow. Do we need to reinvent ourselves,
well, I think we do, in fast.
I think she's smarter than all of us.
Okay.
All right, we've been talking with Charlie Chippio of Chippio Strategies and Dory Clark of Clark Strategic Communications. Her new book, as we just said, Reinventing You, Define Your Brand and Imagine Your Future. Okay, all you guys out on the road right now, if you're driving, make a mental note if you've had a close call today with a cyclist. And if anybody's on a bike right now listening to us on their phone, have you had a close call with a car? What it takes to make our streets safer for everyone on wheels is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston.
The car is no longer king in Boston. That is Tom Menino several months ago. This is Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. All week long, GBH has taken a station-wide look at our car and bike culture. The series is called Right of Way. Today, we kick things off with talking about bike lanes. In a Mass Inc. poll, Marjorie, earlier this year, they found that installing more bike lanes was a low priority for Bay State residents. Mm-hmm. But in a brand new poll, the same, I mean, voters of Massachusetts said that they believe bike lanes were the best way to prevent bicycle accidents. So, sort of an odd coming together. Joining us on the line is Eric Berger. We're going to get to your phone calls, by the way, in a minute on this at 877-301-8970. So you can start lining up. But first, joining us on the phone is Eric Berger. He's of the East Arlington Concerned Citizens Committee. He worked to block the addition of a bike lane on a recent ballot question there earlier in April on Mass Ave. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jim and Marjorie, for having me on and for focusing on this issue.
Thank you.
We also got, is Adam coming on?
No,
later?
A little bit later.
Okay, we've got Eric first then. So, Eric, what is wrong with these bike lanes?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, there was a public referendum, Marjorie, and the majority of residents in the town, and over 55% of the people who live in the seven precincts right around where this 1 mile is, want to keep the four lanes. And I'll tell you what's wrong with it. As a matter of fact, if you put in those bike lanes, it's going to be the worst thing for bikers, and it's going to be increase the number of accidents, we predict. And let me tell you why. To get a feel for this, you have to understand what the corridor is like. This is a 1 mile stretch of road. It's a state and federal highway, Massachusetts Avenue, and it runs straight through the center of the town. And it has four travel lanes on it now, but they're not striped. Now, the town wants to take away for a mile one of these four travel lanes heading west. When you come out of Cambridge and you come into Arlington, you cross the Elwife Brook Parkway, and according to this plan, they're going to narrow down, merge two lanes into one for a mile. And there's going to be no left turn lanes for a half a mile. So if a car stops, everybody behind it stops.
Hey, and there's traffic. There's traffic concerns, too. The merchants there are very concerned about traffic, as I understand it, Eric.
Absolutely. Yep. There's more congestion. Well, yeah, Marjorie, there's 100 businesses along this corridor. There's three transit bus lines and 16 bus stops in this 1 mile. There's constant parking turnover. And when trucks park to make deliveries to these 100 stores, they have to double park right next to the parking lane.
Eric, do you have an alternative idea? Because I think a lot of us are very leery about cars and bikes so close together, and we're worried about the dangerousness.
Sure.
And worried about the accidents.
Well, you know,
what's your alternative?
Well, Marjorie, there's a bike lane, a renowned bike lane, a bike path two blocks away.
The Minuteman you're talking about, right?
Minuteman Bikeway. Yeah. Yes, the Minuteman Bike Path, which is a terrific path, very safe, no cars, no trucks, no buses, no nothing. And it happens to be right near where I live. It's lovely, and it's very safe. So there's the alternative. And the state and the federal government built another bike path that connects from the end of the Minuteman Bikeway down by the Alewife Station that takes you back up to Mass Ave.
Now,
we're surrounded by bike paths, which is great. We love biking, and we want the best for East Arlington. Please understand that.
Eric Berger, and you were leading. The irony of I used to do state ballot questions for a living, and often the wording is really weird. It's a non-binding outcome. You won by roughly 300 votes, but correct me if I'm wrong. A yes vote, which is what you wanted, was a no vote for a bike lane, right? Meaning yes for to keep four lanes, no to it. But isn't there some potential that voters had no idea what they were voting on?
No, please, that's insulting. The chief selectman insulted the over 4,000 voters who voted for this by saying they were confused. I mean, please. I was in public.
Well, Eric, let me be clear. I wasn't trying to insult them. As I said, I used to do ballot campaigns for almost a decade. And the natural inclination, again, I don't know what happened in Arlington. That's why I'm asking you the question. The issue is about bike lanes, it's not unreasonable, is it, for someone who is voting yes to think they're voting for a bike lane? Is that not?
No. Because
why not?
The question says, let me explain. The question says, should the town keep four vehicular travel lanes in East Arlington as now practiced? So if I'm a voter, I say, do I want them to keep the four lanes? Yeah.
So, Eric, what's next? Eric, if you can, tell us what happens next, because I know it's non-binding and it doesn't – obviously the issue is still alive, even though you did win the ballot question by roughly 300 votes. What happens next on your side, at least, Eric?
But we won it, Jim, in the seven precincts around us. We won it by about 800 votes. We won it by a majority of 56%. What's next is – the federal government has asked for eight months, for the town to predict what will be the effects of the merge. In other words, what will the delay be when these two lanes go to one? And also, what will be the delay when you have no left turn lanes for a half mile? You have to factor that in. The town has refused to do that because they know what's going to happen. 98% of the people out here, Jim, travel on this road are in buses, trucks, motor vehicles. We have nothing against sharing the road. We want to share the road. But if you squeeze in two bike lanes, you are going to put the bikers at tremendous risk. Imagine this. You're coming from Cambridge in a car. You cross the Alewife Brook Parkway, and now you come into Arlington, and it merges into one lane. You're now traveling in one lane. Right next to you, if this goes through, is a bike lane. And right next to that bike lane are parked cars. And now you look up ahead, and a truck is double parked because it wants to make a delivery. And it's right in the bike lane and over the bike lane because there's no other room. Now, what does a biker do? You tell me. And now make believe it's dark at night, or make believe it's in the winter. That biker is stuck. That biker either swings out into the one travel lane and, God forbid, tries to squeeze by that truck, or he stops his bike. He can't go on the sidewalk. That's illegal. And if I'm stuck behind a car, and I'm in a car behind a car that's stopped to make a left, I can't go around it because I'm going to go in the bike lane. God forbid, people, and we think that might happen.
We got it. Eric Berger, before you go, what's your website if people in other communities either share your view or want to talk to you? How do they find you at the East Arlington Concerned Citizens
Thanks
Committee?
Thanks for the time, Jim. www.savemassav.com. And I'm sure there's main roads in every single town in this state.
Eric, I have one question. You say bikist instead of bicyclist. I should talk because I mispronounce everything, but why bikist?
Well, I just said that. Bicyclist is better.
Oh, bicyclist.
Right.
Okay. Just wondering.
You're right. You're right.
It's okay.
Eric, thanks and congratulations on your ballot victory. Well, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for joining us, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. And now joining us on the phone to give us the other side is Adam Oster.
Yes,
the East Arlington Livable Streets Coalition formed a response to the planning process for the Mass Ave Corridor Project. Well, you just heard a little bit, at least, of Eric Adam, and you know everything about this because this is your pro-bike lane deal. Why is Eric wrong, and why are you right?
Well, I'm not really sure I can answer that. The project is not primarily about bicycles. It's about fixing up the road and making it safer for pedestrians. In a nutshell, the street's in poor condition and has to be rebuilt. The state and federal government will pay for it if the design meets their requirements, and a four-lane design does not meet those requirements and also is not safe.
And it's close to $7 million in state and federal funds, right? $6.8 million or something
That's
like that?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So why was your perspective, and I assume it was your perspective, that adding a bike lane, which obviously meant the addition and then subtraction, why was this the right outcome here?
Well, the bike lane, as I said, is sort of incidental. I mean, it's arguably a plus for cyclists, especially for new cyclists who sort of need the reassurance of the bike lane. But if there were no such thing as a bicycle, we would still want the features of this design that entail removing a travel lane that's not needed.
How are the pedestrians unsafe, Adam, with the way the road is constructed now with the four lanes as opposed to the two lanes?
Well, I think if you spend any time observing traffic now, you would conclude that bicycles and cars actually do very well under the current arrangement, and there's not very much bicycle-motor vehicle conflict either. But pedestrians really have a rough time.
Why?
It's hard to get across the street. The average speed is above the speed limit, and there is injury and death.
We should say, for those who don't know, it's a very wide Mass Ave in this particular part of Arlington, right across the Cambridge line, is very wide, and there's no island in it. There's no island. Am I right about that?
That's right. And historically, the reason for that is that there used to be a trolley line going right up the center of the street.
So are there not enough crosswalks, or there aren't enough stop signs, or there aren't enough lights, or, you know, because a lot of streets are dangerous to pedestrians if, obviously, they're in them.
Unsignalized crosswalks are dangerous.
Right.
Particularly on multi-lane roads. There's a kind of accident that that happens when there are two lanes going in one direction and there's a crossing and a car obstructs the sight lines for the car in the other lane.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Highway Administration has a name for that. They call it a multiple lane threat accident. And we have those on Mass Ave. So getting rid of the unneeded travel lane gets rid of half of those.
So, Adam Alster, just to be clear, and you've said it, but I want to make it sure, even had there not been a bike lane added, and obviously the vote isn't going to advance that, at least even though it's non-binding, your issue was reducing the number of motor vehicle traffic lanes, not so much whether or not there was a bike lane. You really don't care, right?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, if there's room for a bike lane, we're for it. Arlington's a bike-friendly town. Bike lanes can be good things, depending on the context. They're not useful everywhere. This seems to be a good place to have one. But if you didn't put one there and you wanted to achieve the same goals, you'd have to do actually something more radical. You'd have to either widen the sidewalks or you'd have to build up some kind of raised median in the center. Our police and fire chiefs didn't want to do the second of those things.
Why is that, by the way? What's wrong? The median notion, and a lot of that part of Cambridge that leads into Arlington has a median there. What is the police chief's objection, putting aside the bike issue? What's the objection to a median?
Well, at the risk of not doing justice to the police or the fire chief, my understanding is concerns about emergency responders being able to hop a lane, basically.
I see. Got it. Adam Alster, what's your website if people want to talk to you guys at the East Arlington Livable Streets Coalition? Do you have one?
Yes, that's EALS Coalition, EALS Coalition.org.
Adam Alster, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being on Boston Public Radio.
A pleasure. Thank you.
877-301-8970 is our number. Let's focus not on Arlington. Let's focus on the whole bike lanes added in urban areas thing. Marjorie and I have slightly different opinions on this. And
don't forget the email, Jim.
And our email is BPR, Boston Public Radio, BPR@WGBH.org. You know, I am one who believes exactly. Can we hear Tom Menino one more time just to get us into the mood? Here's Tom Menino. I think it was sometime in 2012. Here it is.
The car is no longer king in Boston.
I love that. I mean, it doesn't get any
better,
Jim, than that.
Do you notice what's right outside the parking garage here at WGBH?
No, I don't know.
A whole line of bikes.
I know that.
You could be zipping right into work every day.
No, but let me tell you. Let me explain where I am.
Mr. Bike.
Rather than you explaining what my position is before we get to the calls.
You love bikes.
My position
for everybody
is,
else.
My position is I'm in favor of more bikes in urban areas. Uh-huh. My concern, though, is safety. In this poll from Mass Inc. that was commissioned by WGBH that just came out in the last, I think, in the last 24 hours. I think it was just released this morning. In your opinion, which of the following would be the most effective way to prevent bike accidents? Overwhelmingly, the number one choice was install more bike lanes. A fairly distant number two is improve enforcement of existing traffic laws. I'm one who believes that's the latter is hugely important because a huge number of cyclists don't obey the traffic mm-hmm. laws that apply to them as much as people drive in cars, and it leads to lots of horrible outcomes. The problem I have is when you just add a bike lane alongside a traffic lane, a vehicular traffic lane, as the saying goes, in urban areas, I don't think it does much to deal with the safety issue. You know, we were talking, every time I mention Paris, you like make fun of me, mm-hmm. but I'm going to do it anyway.
Okay.
In lots of parts of Paris where there are tons of bikes, where I actually rode a bike, Marjorie, I know it's hard to believe.
Yeah, I want to see the pictures.
There's a little tiny island between the cars and the bicycles,
which is
so
huge.
That they're segregated.
Which is huge.
That you'd support well, that, right? If there was room,
I'm not opposed to bikes. I'm opposed to the terror in the bicyclist and the driver when you're too close in the road,
which you are completely all the time.
So why not have the bike lanes between the sidewalk and the parked cars?
Because there's not enough room for them in most cities. That's the problem.
Well, if you haven't, how can you say there's not enough room for them there? If there's enough room for them between the parked cars,
because the little island adds another 3-4 feet of space that has to disappear. The island has got to come from somewhere.
An island between drivers
and – oh, you just mean on the right side of the parked cars?
Yes, on the right side of the parked cars, close to the sidewalk or on the sidewalks, or maybe this will never happen.
Well, it can't be on the sidewalk,
obviously.
Because
you have an elevated L, you know what I mean, like the orange line used to be for the bicyclists to ride around. It's just – I mean, I've been on both sides of this. It's so nerve-wracking as a driver, and it's really scary as a bicyclist. And it's amazing
to
me there aren't more tragedies because you're only like 2 feet apart. And if somebody opens the door unexpectedly and you're the bicyclist – that's coming down the road, you have to swerve, and then you're not far apart, and there's a car behind you, and you have to swerve to avoid the open door, and you see that all the time.
And by the way, the line from many cyclists is that there's this colossal animosity from drivers towards cyclists. And if there is animosity, and there obviously is animosity in some, but you know what that's generated from? It's from fear more than it is antagonism.
That's not what it's generated from. Here's what it's generated from. Say you're coming down Commonwealth Avenue mm-hmm. where there is a red light every block, you know, and you pass the bike between Hereford and Gloucester. And then you get up to the light at Gloucester and the bike passes you again. And then you pass the bike between Gloucester and Fairfield. And then the damn bike passes you again. You spend your entire, whatever it is, mile driving down Commonwealth Avenue, jousting with this bicyclist who inevitably beats you because they just zip around the corner on Arlington Street. It drives you crazy. That's what
they don't obey. Not all, but a significant number of cyclists don't obey traffic laws, which is not only aggravating, but it is really dangerous.
It's because sometimes in traffic, the bikes go faster than the cars.
Our number is
877-301-8970
or bpr@wgbh.org. There was a major debate in Arlington, even though, as you heard from the guy who was on the other side of the anti-bike lane movement there, it wasn't so much about the bike lanes, but it is the major battle. Tom Menino is a huge advocate of more biking in Boston, a huge advocate. Remember before he got hurt, not the most recent injury, but maybe a year or two ago.
He used to ride.
He was biking every morning at 5 o'clock until he got hit by a car, right? Didn't the guy open a door and hit him or something?
I don't remember
how he
got hurt.
And he had some sort of injury.
But also Hyde Park is a little bit more bike friendly because a lot of the roads are wider out
there. See, you know what you need here? You need a leader who is willing to acknowledge that it's not, in my opinion, as simple as to bike lane or not bike lane. That is the question. There needs to be physical separation for people to be safe.
But it's fairly obvious, isn't it? I mean, the roads were built for cars, and now we're trying to put this whole other group of people in roads that aren't getting any wider in most cases. I mean, I think if the roads were wider, it were made more safe, you wouldn't have to be scared all the time, then people would be not so hostile toward trying to mix the two together, Jim.
877-301-8970. We're talking about bike lanes as part of the series that's starting in virtual on the web, on TV, on radio, just all week this week on WGBH. Let's start with Michael in Roxbury. You're next on Boston Public Radio, Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Michael.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a couple of things to say about this. The first one is that pedestrians and bicyclists and their needs on the roads, in Boston anyway, are handled by the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation's job is to move vehicles. So pedestrians and bicyclists are secondary, and we need a separate department for pedestrians and bicyclists. The second second thing is that...
Well, by the way, let's start there. I mean, it seems to me we just got to make them a little more sensitive. So if you have two separate departments, each advocating for their own constituency, then the reality, it's going to be like the intelligence agencies on the federal level. They never talk to each other.
Well, that's, of course, you know, that's an issue in anything. But I think that, you know, the Department of Transportation is automobile-centric. And they've had every reason to be for a very long time.
Sure.
But also Boston is such a dense city. We cannot widen streets because there are buildings in the way. But we absolutely have to redesign how automobiles are moving, how many lanes there are, how much parking there is.
I agree with that.
If we're going to make safe lanes for bicyclists, which, as you said, involves bicycle islands. And it's not just France. It's the Netherlands. It's Belgium. It's Germany. It's all over.
By the way, before you continue, Michael, the Alliance for Biking and Walking's 2012 benchmarking report, do you believe this? Boston is ranked 8th on the list of cities that are safest to bike in America.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. But go ahead, Michael. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Almost every bicyclist I know has had an accident in the city. And almost every time it's because they're riding in the bike lane, somebody in a park car opens their door, and they drive into
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
And that's not the bicyclist's fault or the driver's fault. You don't just throw a bicycle lane in because
you want
to bike.
Yeah, they're too close. They're too close.
So, unfortunately, I really think, and this ties into pedestrians, you cannot put bicycles on the sidewalk. You can't put pedestrians in the street. So, sorry, folks, we're going to have to probably get rid of some street parking. We're going to have to turn some four lanes into three lanes or four lanes into two lanes. And also, a lot of two-way streets are going to have to become one-way streets. And we're going to have to redesign how everybody moves in the city in order for it to accommodate everything.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Michael from Roxbury, thank you much for your call. You could be the head of the Mass Department of Cyclists and Pedestrians. Margaret,
you know why?
You
know
were
why
fine
this works
with what
so
he said
well?
Until he said eliminated parking spaces, right?
Well, you know why this works so well in France, Jim, and Italy, and a lot of these foreign countries? What's
that?
The big difference between their cars and our cars?
They're little tiny things.
Little teeny tiny things.
That's actually a good point.
Everybody gets rid of their huge SUVs and they have these Chevy Suburbans that are like as wide as buses, I mean, they have those smart cars all over the place.
You know, Michael made a good point, though, that I think undercuts your notion of you don't need a physical barrier. The car can be the physical barrier. Well, just like he says, opening the driver's door is the cause of a lot of accidents. Why isn't opening the passenger door going to be a cause of a lot of accidents if there's no barrier between the cyclist and the driver?
Well, it's a problem, too. I am not an engineer. I just know that the cars and the bikes are too close on the roads, and everybody's a nervous wreck about it.
Did you read the other day what prominent American was in his third major bicycle accident in the last 20 years and had to have a shoulder replacement as a result of it?
No.
Cambridge guy, Steve Breyer, Supreme Court Justice.
Really?
In Washington the other day, 74 years old. It's the third time he's had a serious. He's in Georgetown University Hospital, taken by ambulance, and to have shoulder replacement surgery as a result of a bicycling accident near the Korean War Veterans Memorial. They won't say more about what caused it. But he's obviously an avid cyclist and looks very fit if you take a look at this guy at 74. And three times, serious injuries.
Alex from Waltham, what do you think about bikes and cars?
Hi, Jim. Hi, Audrey. Love the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So I'm actually a truck driver and a motorcyclist, and my family's a big, my dad's a big cyclist. He works for the nonprofit Bikes Not Bombs in Jamaica Plain. And we're trying to raise public awareness for health and cycling. And I think that more focusing on the inner cities like Dorchester, Roxbury, Jamaica Plain, the more bike lanes you put in there, maybe the less cars would be on the road, but also the worry about getting doored by a car. If you put the bike lanes on the left side, and so they're both oncoming on to each other, I think it would raise awareness for the cars themselves to see the cyclists, and also they wouldn't have to worry about getting hit on each side.
Oh, you mean the bicyclists driving toward the cars? Like you see a lot of runners run toward the cars.
Exactly. But
yeah.
not on the other side of the road, but if they ride on the yellow line, on the inside of the lane, instead of on the parking side. Especially on places like Commonwealth Avenue, when you're coming into Boston, where there's actually a big median, and there's actually no worry about oncoming traffic.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because bicyclists are supposed to go with traffic as the rules are now, but you never see runners, or you rarely see runners going with traffic. You see runners going the other way.
Sure.
Because why? You don't want to, you want to not worry that a car is coming up behind you and going to run you over. That's a very clever idea, Alex. I kind of like that.
Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. I'm thinking about it, Marjorie.
Thank
you,
Alex.
Let me read you one section of this GBH poll. And by the way, the pollster was Mass Inc. Polling Group. In your opinion, which of the following would be the most effective way to prevent bike accidents? 41%. Is this right? Yeah. Oh, actually, it depends on income range. And somewhere in the 40s, say install more bike lanes. Around low double digits, pass stricter traffic laws for cars and bicycles. Anywhere, depending on your income or age, somewhere around 20%, improve enforcement of existing traffic laws. A little bit less than that, enhance education about traffic. And don't know is about 10%, which I think is probably the most honest answer. 877-301-8970. The reality is with there is going to be a move, a dramatic move in cities around this country, because there is around the world, particularly in the Western world and Western Europe. Well, it's not just Western Europe. I mean, look at the times I've been in China. There's so many cyclists, and that's in part because a lot of people don't own cars. So someone's got to find a way for them to coexist. And you know what drives me totally crazy in terms
totally
of safety?
Jim.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Hubway, and I know you're not. The fact that they haven't yet figured out a really creative way, I know they started, to make sure that people can rent helmets along with the bikes. You're riding this bike. The assumption is you're not a great cyclist mm-hmm. if you're renting one of these bikes. You're sort of a casual cyclist like I am. The fact that they don't require helmets on those, or at least make them readily available, why are you smirking at me?
What about head lice, Jim?
No, I'm sorry. Head lice is, I mean, by the way, that is an issue. It's not a non-issue.
It's in the first grade, it's in the third grade. Pretty soon it'll be on the bikeway.
You are a nattering nabob of negativism, Margaret,
you know what? I was
to quote
just in New York,
the former vice president.
I was just in New York over the weekend. I can't recall seeing too many bicyclists competing with the cab drivers.
Should I tell you my story?
Oh,
many years
means.
Ago, I've told you this before. Many years ago, this is a true story. I bought my first 10-speed. And I lived on the Upper West Side, and I worked on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I decided, this is a totally true story, and it was much more expensive than I could afford, even though by these standards, it was not like a John Kerry kind of bike, but it was more than I could afford at the time. So I started riding down from the 80s on Riverside Drive to the Lower East Side to the East Village. I got a flat tire about a halfway through. This is a true story. Tried to hail a cab to get to work. They wouldn't pick me up because I had a bike with it. I took my 10-speed, I put it in a garbage can, and I did not ride a bike again for maybe 15 years. So obviously I have a little urban bias.
How old were you, Jim, when you did this?
Maybe
21?
35 or something.
35.
I was, yeah.
Very mature.
Threw it right in the garbage.
Okay. Let's go to Claudia in New Hampshire. Hi, Claudia.
Hello, Claudia.
Hi, how are you today?
Excellent.
Good.
Thanks for the call.
I'm calling because I have an 8-year-old daughter. When she was 16, she was hit as a pedestrian and was very, very, very injured and had shattered her pelvis. And she was not a driver at the time. And she is a driver now. She's recovered very well. She's doing fantastic. And we're kind of country bumpkins, but we do go into Boston a lot. And when she drives, she constantly comments that the bicyclists particularly, and also the pedestrians, seem to have an attitude that they're protected by magic. And I really do agree with her, maybe because I'm not a Boston driver, but I think that there has to be more education or some kind of training for people on the roads to be sharing cars and bikes. It's not just the driver's responsibility. It is also the person who's using another form of transportation. And they take a lot of chances. And I don't really understand it as like sort of a country driver. So I just wanted to say that as somebody who sort of lives through this experience of having somebody get very injured, I don't get why people take such risks.
By the way, I think your education thing on both sides makes – my kid just took a driver's education course before she passed her – my younger kid before she passed her driver's test. I should ask her. I have no idea if part of the education – she went for a lot of hours, classroom as well as on-road training – I have no idea if they taught her about how to interact with the cyclists that are riding down the roads in Arlington, Cambridge, Boston, all that sort of stuff. Claudia, thanks. What's that?
Yep, thank you.
No, go ahead.
I think the basic premise is that they kind of say the minute somebody's toe is entering towards a street or a crosswalk, you're supposed to let them do whatever they do. But a lot, like I said, a lot of people seem to just have this attitude that the second they've decided they're going to do it, their assumption is that the driver is going to behave correctly.
Hey, Claudia, yeah. Before you go away, you're in Nashville, right, which is a smaller city. What's the cycle versus driver situation up there?
Okay, well, I don't actually live in Nashville. That's where I'm calling.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I live in Pepperell, mm-hmm. and we do have the rail trail up there, which we share as walkers, bikers, and actually horseback riding. And, you know, it's actually a very polite system, and everybody sort of shouts out to each other, like, to the left, to the right. And, you know, you move around a lot, but you have to really communicate because you actually could actually, while somebody's walking and biking, without a car, somebody can get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's great. Who wants to stop bicyclists from getting around? Nobody does, you know? I just think it has to be that people have to be a little bit more cautious and polite to one another while they're out there.
Claudia, thanks. We're glad your daughter's better. Thank you, Claudia.
You know, let me ask you a quick question.
Yeah.
Your kid just took the driver's ed,
yep.
the test, right,
yes.
to drive.
Yes, second
now,
time, yeah.
Did you feel as though the actual test was thorough enough?
Yeah.
You did?
That was great.
I went
and had to sit in the back seat,
okay.
which is one of the most terrifying experiences for a parent in history. You got to be in
did
the.
Did you go on the highway?
We went to heavily trafficked streets. The guy who did it in Watertown was, I'm not going to say his name, was spectacular.
Well, I think that would be an unusual experience because I think what you often find, at least with my children, you drive around the block, you parallel park, and then you do where you don't get your license. No one's going to drive fast. No one's going out in the highway. They're too fast and they're too easy. And parallel parking is very important. I think being able to get in and off the highway.
I agree with that.
Is a big
lane
deal.
Shifting. Can I say one more thing about
what?
This? And then we'll take another
call. I wonder why they can't drive with bikes.
You've mocked me for maybe 15 years now
yep.
about my cycling habits or non-cycling habits. I'm telling you right here, I'm saying this on the air. Just like Menino said, the car is no longer
yeah.
king of Boston.
Okay.
If there was an island, if there was a division, between the cars, I'm saying this, if there was a division between the cars and the bicycles, I would be cycling lots
okay,
of places.
Jim has been training on his big boy bike now how many years to do the Pan Mass Challenge, Jim?
I'm going to do it this August.
And he's working to get a block down the street. I think he's trying to get from his house to Mass Ave.
No,
it's about 300 feet.
Well, I'm tall. You need a big
he's
boy bike.
He's working on it.
Let's go to Elba in Jamaica Plain. Elba, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, hey.
Hi, guys. I listen to you all the time.
We love
you. Know,
that.
I wanted to tell you. I wanted to tell you about this intersection between. It's on the South Corridor in Jamaica Plain.
Yeah.
Between Columbus and Heath, and that is the worst intersection in the city of Boston.
It is.
Because
it's wide.
The drivers never stop before. You know how there is the intersection where it allows you to cross the street if you
yeah.
want. They never stop before the line. They always, they basically are trying to get out to Columbus Avenue before you have the opportunity of being able to cross the street. And I fell about 3-4 years ago. I fell because there was this one driver that was speeding. The light was green for me. This guy was speeding so fast that I sort of, you know, rushed my bike and fell. And I have not been on my bike since because I became terrified.
So what, Elba, what happened? Did this person, were they apprehended to use a term?
No. The guy was in a rush. So he was able to, you know,
it's a horrible
go
story,
through
actually.
And, you know, he turned right on Columbus because you can, you know, there's a sign that says that you, or no sign that says that you can't turn on your right. And he just went by very happy, and I was on the ground, and you know,
how are you?
Happy and
that's awful.
I'm fine.
But
it
it's in your head, right? You're scared. I mean, by the way, your kind of story is exactly why I'm scared to go out in the city on a bicycle. No, that's a real problem.
I used to bike all the time to work. I biked from Jamaica Plain all the way to my job here at Greater Boston Legal Services. I biked all the time, winter, spring, summer, fall. And when that happened to me, that was it. I stopped.
Oh,
so,
Elba, I'm so sorry.
I don't want to discourage you guys, but, you know, just be careful. You know, helmet is important, and don't be in a hurry.
Elba, thank you very much.
Say hi to everybody at Greater Boston Legal Services for me. Thanks, Elba, for the call.
Thanks.
And So
that's where Jim left his bike at Greater Boston Legal
No, I left it in the garbage can
for it.
On maybe 45th Street on the west side
okay.
of Manhattan. You know, we're going to do a segment on bikes every single day this week, taking a different aspect because of the series that's going on here called Right of Way on television, on radio, on the web, and we're going to try to solve some of these problems.
That's right. And tonight at Greater Boston, Emily's show at 7 o'clock, they're going to be talking about right of way as well, with a look at moving through the city from a driver's point of view. I think it might be Emily as the driver, and a cyclist point of view. That should be lots of fun. Up next is time for Open Mic with the Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is Open Mic time. He joins us every Monday on Open Mic. That, of course, would be the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Reverend Rivers, good to talk to you.
Good afternoon, good people. How are we doing?
We're doing very, very well. Reverend Rivers, I wanted to start by asking you, because we have talked about this 2 weeks in a row now with you here on Boston Public Radio, about, you know, everybody is really upset by the Boston Marathon, and everybody's concerned about helping people get back on, get better, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But there is this weird thing where there are constantly shootings in Boston, Mattapan, Dorchester, and killings. And there seems to be not the same sort of effort to raise money, raise funds. It's on the front page of the Metro section in the Globe today. And you had an event at the Ella Baker House where people were talking about this in Dorchester over the weekend. What's going on?
Two things. One, after the immediately after the tragedy of the marathon, you know, the appropriate response was to empathize and communicate because it was a shock to the system, major commercial area, and there was the fact that it was explicitly a terrorist initiative, as it's become clear. Now, the issue that I want to raise, and I really want to engage the entire city, from the governor to city officials, is the question of white life versus black life. The issue here again, and I just want to raise the question, we have terrorism on Boylston Street. We have terrorism in Dorchester. I was actually walking by the Walgreens on Warren Street in Roxbury just before the shooting, where the two individuals were murdered on Friday. And my daughter raised the question. She said, what are the conditions under which it would be appropriate to raise the question of whether or not there is a disparity in levels of concern and commitment when you've got terrorism going on. We have the Harlem Street murders where the three girls were murdered last summer, right? Then you've got the Mattapan massacre. And these are cases where children are traumatized, and the traumatization of the children is underdocumented. And then worse than that is the fact that we have a community that's almost desensitized to their own self-destruction, which is an amazing development, right? And so what's the appropriate context to have the public have a rational discussion around what we do? And then let me ask this, Jim. Jim, when Mark Wahlberg is organizing this concert, do you know if there was any black group that was listed in names and faces that's going to participate in this big concert?
I would assume the answer is no, if you're asking me the question that way. Is that the right answer, Gene?
I think it's the right answer, although I thought I just asked it to be polite.
No, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I read down the list of... But so when your daughter asked you this question, what'd you say to her?
It's fascinating. I mean, and I'm just background. Sojourner Rivers graduated from Harvard College last year, works for the Public Health Commission, and, you know, it's a sensitive liberal. She thinks her dad's a caveman, but that makes sense, right?
Right.
And so she says, Dad, I'm empathetic. I understand. I get it, right? The horror and the terror, right? I understand the lockdown. But I said there are a series of questions that are not being asked. So, okay, got it. Now, when there's terrorism in the black community, right, what should the response be? Now, the first part of my answer, Jim, is that black leadership has failed to force this as a priority. The leadership, I mean the religious leaders, the black political leaders, have failed to make this a priority because what's being said, if we, you know, if we get real with it, Jim and Marjorie, white folks say, we ain't having it. This madness ain't going down, and we're going to hunt these dudes down, and we're going to get them.
But wait a second, Gene Rivers, let me disagree. You say that you were described white folks aren't down with this. Let me read to you from two white folks who are in this Globe story. The police commissioner, Ed Davis, there's been an outpouring of sympathy from across the world that does not attach to what happens day in and day out. And I think that's a tragedy. I think that each life is precious. Each life should receive the same type of attention. Then Tom Menino, after quoting what little Martin Richard said, no more hurting people, he says, and this is again a quote, we have to put an end to violence in our neighborhoods and the senseless scourge of guns. It seems to me if there was ever a time for black leaders, as you described them with a broad brush, to say, we agree with what you, Ed Davis, said and what you, Tom Menino, said. Now here's where the rubber hits the road. Now's the time. No? I mean, they're saying it. Now they got to walk the walk.
No. Absolutely. And there needs to be discussions. I was with Ed Davis yesterday morning before my work day began at some breakfast at the Union Hall to, you know, the last major breakfast for Mayor Menino. And so when I spoke to Commissioner Davis, I said, Ed, would like to get together with you to have a conversation about prevention and intervention around what's going on with the over 20 shootings that have happened since the marathon. Right. And so the commissioner completely gets this and completely understands it. And as Peter discovered in our task force meeting, we raised the issue in a sensitive way and we're not finger pointing. But I have to say this, black leadership have not been vocal, and you are right. They need to step up now and focus and say, how do we commit resources in a proportionally in a fair way to address the terrorism that happens in the inner city neighborhoods of this town?
We're talking with the Reverend Gene Rivers about the seemed disparate attention, marathon tragedy versus the tragedy that's kind of a continuing tragedy in the inner cities of Boston and all across America. How does this translate, though, you know, Gene Rivers? I mean, I've thought about this, you know, myself. What do? Do you put the National Guard on the corner of Geneva and Bowdoin in Boston where there's a lot of problems? Do you have a curfew? You can't have a lockdown. I mean, what do?
Number one, there needs to be a discussion with law enforcement, the Public Health Commission, religious leaders, political leaders on the ground about prevention and intervention. There need to be three components: prevention, intervention, and enforcement. And what Boston is unique in the country, we are the first city that actually got that combination right, and that's been the case for the last 20 years. And Boston is unique in that regard. Now, there has to be a re-engagement of the issue. Now, on your business about lockdown, let me tell you something. The National Guard should be sent into the south and west side of Chicago, where more Americans die in the south and west side of Chicago than die in Afghanistan.
But there's a harassment. There's a harassment fear, isn't there? And a legitimate harassment fear. I mean, who wants to, you know what I'm saying? I'm asking you what to do. On the other hand, how do you live like that with the National Guard at every 10 feet? I mean, I'm a chicken. I kind of would like it, but I could see where, you know, the possibility of people getting shot.
About that? Let me say something, Marjorie. Excellent question. You know who complains about that?
Who?
Brookline white liberals who don't live in the hood.
Right.
90% of the people that complain about that are Brookline, Newton, white liberals from the ACLU who live safely removed from the environment where five-year-old children have to duck, right, when they hear gunshots. I had a conversation with the Boston police at our task force meeting. I said, do you know that these stuff is actually underreported? And they agreed because they have a thing called shot spotters, and these electronic devices can identify firecrackers as opposed to shots. And the number of shots that take place in Roxbury, Dorchester, matter of fact. It's crazy. And children who live in this environment of terror are then expected to go on and take the MCAS test and do extremely well. Or get penalized for not doing so.
So, Reverend Rivers, since you haven't asked me for my advice yet, but I'm going to give it to you anyway.
I want your advice.
Well, I knew you did.
Great one.
Right, Reverend Rivers, here's what I would suggest. Since it seems to me that both Ed Davis and Tom Menino, who actually I believe care deeply about the issues you care about, they're not just doing the lip service thing that so many police commissioners and so many mayors do around the country. I think they do care. Why don't you, and you talk about black leaders not doing what they should, you and the Ministerial Alliance or the 10-point coalition, or whatever it is, come up right. with a concrete 10-point plan. No rhetoric. No.
Absolutely.
Here's what we need to get the right. kind of attention that within the real world that's affordable and that will make our communities safe. So there's something to talk about, because all there really is now is this rhetorical warfare back and forth, which really doesn't get anybody anywhere.
You know what, Jim? That's why you're just the most brilliant dude
oh,
in
God.
The world.
Okay, I'm sorry
Absolutely.
I said it.
Now, I just can't stand it.
No, but
you're such a saint.
Thank you.
The audacity
really
is overwhelming.
I brought this up.
I barely can stand up under the light.
Fine.
It's true. It's true, Gene Rivers. I have a difficult time every day. But get back. Hold on for one second, though. You were saying how the white liberals from Brooklyn, that would describe me, of course, think it's a terrible idea, the National Guard thing. But that's baloney. You know that. You hear mothers in your neighborhood saying they're worried about their 16 and 18 and 19-year-old sons getting harassed or accidentally
shot by that
police.
What was the name of that community? Wait, before you go ahead, Reverend Rivers, for a second. What was the name of that community policing program that was embraced by Ed Davis, originally not by Menino, then was by Menino, that many people in communities of color in Boston
were
resisting big time?
No. Listen. Let's talk about that. This was some genius. And the BPD came up with the idea that they should publicize and circulate the photographs of guys that were known to the police.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It got picked up by MSNBC and NBC, and I ended up on TV, right, talking about this deal. And they pulled it down in 24 hours, right, because it wasn't the smartest thing they'd ever done. That's one thing. No, we're not talking about martial law, Marjorie. What we're saying is that there needs to be targeted, aggressive policing that goes after the bad guys. No, this is not some indiscriminate, you know, kind of movie, make my day, authoritarian stuff. No.
More cops in the street? More visible cops in the street?
But let me give you the difference. And I want to go to Jim's point. There needs to be more intelligent prevention and intervention, which is infinitely more cost effective. Just logically. To go to Jim's point about getting beyond the rhetoric, you know, and the hoo-ha, and talking about substantive, programmatic things, what are needed is an investment which is minuscule by comparison in solid prevention, intervention programs. And, Jim, I've got a practical suggestion for you.
What is it?
There need to be drop-in centers that literally take children off the street that are open 7 days a week to provide wraparound services. And there's money to do that because it's not a big high-ticket item.
Well, you know, a variation on a theme I'm thinking as you speak.
Midnight,
remember Midnight
Basketball?
I can't believe you thought of that, Martin. Remember when Bill Clinton was ridiculed for an idea that I thought was terrific? What did you think of Midnight Basketball?
And let me say, Midnight Basketball, anything that gets a young Negro, because there are Negroes in my neighborhood, right, that to keep a gun out of his hand, I'll take a basketball over a gun any day of the year.
Okay, so Reverend Rivers, here's my concrete proposal to you. And we have one more thing for you before you go away. You're going to be here in 7 days in studio. You're on the phone today because we have a little bit of a mix-up. Why don't you come in with three concrete proposals that you think are that you think are affordable, and why don't you, Marjorie, and I start a discussion with our listeners about them? How about that? It's a deal. Okay,
One more thing.
Reverend Rivers, I mean, you've called him a genius now three times.
He knows the way
in
my heart.
What am I, chopped liver over here?
Love chopped liver.
Say something nice about me, please?
No. Marjorie,
yes.
You're our mentor.
Our mentor. Okay, thank you very much. I'll take it.
Speak
I'd rather
yourself,
be a genius,
reason,
but I'll take it.
The reason Jim's a Jesus is that he gets the glow. No.
Let's move on. Reverend Rivers, last question. In a couple of seconds, we're going to invite listeners to call in and ask us whether they agree with Peter Stefan.
Oh,
he is the guy that runs the funeral home in Worcester, who took the body of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. And he says, to quote him, that everybody is entitled to a dignified burial. As a man of the cloth, do you agree with him? I mean, as you know, no city, including my hometown of Cambridge, will allow this guy, the older brother, to be buried there. Does he deserve a dignified burial?
He deserves a dignified burial, but as everyone knows, with an IQ over 5, this is all political.
Meaning?
This is just a political, it's a political hot potato. Because, I mean, you know what it's like? It's like whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald, who is the guy that, reputedly assassinated John Kennedy, right?
Yeah. I don't think it's much reputedly, but go ahead.
Okay, no. Who shot John Kennedy in the book Depository?
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
Fine. Right? Okay, fine, got it. All right, trying to bury him. Listen, this is one of these, now, I don't know what the answer is to this, because no one's going to touch this political hot potato. But, he deserves a dignified burial because the United States is a civilized society.
Yeah,
Gene
that's
Rivers,
right.
Reverend Rivers, thank you. And by the way, three concrete items next Tuesday at 1 o'clock, and
okay.
We'll talk around. Reverend Rivers,
brother.
Thanks.
Thank you very much,
bye.
Reverend Gene Rivers, for calling Jim a genius 3 times and me a mentor. Okay? I'll take what I can get. That's the Reverend Gene Rivers. He joins us every Monday at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Gene, as always. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Charlie Baker. We're going to continue talking about what we talked about before, the whole issue of the poor funeral director up there in Worcester can't find any place to bury the body of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Officials and his family don't know where he's going to be buried. As Jim said, Cambridge rejected him. Other private cemeteries have rejected him. What to do with the body of Tamerlan Tsarnaev? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio. This is Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Our number is 877-301-8970. One of the big debates, and there are many debates on many different levels about the Tsarnaev brothers, is what should happen to the body of the older brother, Tamerlan. As you know, a guy who runs a Worcester funeral parlor, his name is Peter Stefan, I believe is how you pronounce it, took him. He said, quote, everybody is entitled to a dignified burial. Cambridge wouldn't take him, even though the uncle who has come to claim the body, the uncle from Maryland, who said both of his nephews were losers after he found out what they had done. Now, he was great, I thought, on the air, even though I think he slighted, well, we'll get into this some other time, about the Armenians in general with a stupid comment he made. But in terms of his nephews, he was pretty straightforward. He came and claimed the body. He said he should be buried in Cambridge because that was his hometown for roughly 10 years. The city manager of Cambridge, Bob Healy, said, no, don't even ask for a permit here. It's a big mistake. Is he entitled to a dignified burial? Gene Rivers, Reverend Eugene Rivers, said yes. There's a guy on the other side from Worcester who says no and is willing to put his money where his mouth is. This guy, William Brault, I believe, B-R-E-A-U-L-T, told the Telegram and Gazette, that's the major paper down there in Worcester, that he's putting together a fund to which he's contributed $500 so that the body can be shipped back to Russia, where Tsarnaev's parents live. He said it will take somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000, and he is seeking contributions. What should happen here? 877-301-8970. And by the way, while the media has covered the protests outside the funeral home, I should say, and they're getting huge coverage, the number of people who've been protesting is quite modest. It looks like when you look at the videos, maybe a dozen and a half, that sort of thing. But the reality is virtually no community in Massachusetts wants the body, Marjorie, because they're worried. As Bob Healy said, it would be a potential breach of the peace because there are going to be some protests. There are going to be some actions and that sort of thing. So what do you do here? There are a couple of people who have gone on our Facebook page at Boston Public Radio. Phil said, personally comprehending why there's a protest about the final resting spot is beyond me, as is protesting at the funeral home. While the act may be unforgivable, there's no reason to torment someone who's dead or their family trying to put the whole thing to risk. Well, obviously not his whole family, because his wife wanted nothing to do with it. And Tracy says they should dispose of this terrorist like Osama and all future terrorists. And as you recall, after the United States complied with all the Muslim burial customs, washing and wrapping the body of Osama bin Laden, they disposed of him at sea. And a lot of people are saying that's a suitable outcome here, too. I thought the most important thing Gene Rivers said, and I'm going to paraphrase, is we've got to make clear we're better than them and that this is a civilized society.
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure if I was the city manager at Cambridge, I'm not sure I'd want him there either. But you know what? Now what this guy is saying, this Peter Stefan, the funeral home guy, he's going to the governor. If that doesn't work out, he's going
John
to the president.
John Kerry.
Is that what he said?
Secretary
I didn't know
of
that.
State. Yeah, Peter Gosnell has a great column suggesting that, you know, that John Kerry intervened for like a mercy deportation of the body back to his homeland. You know, Gene Rivers also mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot John Kennedy.
What happened to him?
He was buried in the furthest reaches of a cemetery in Fort Worth, Texas, and cemetery workers were instructed, whether that's still true all these many years later, I don't know, but certainly at the time, not to tell anybody that came to the cemetery where the grave was located. He was buried next to his mother there. And Timothy McVeigh was cremated.
Well, you can't cremate Muslims.
You cannot cremate by the Ted Bundy, another notorious serial killer. He was cremated as well. So it makes you curious what happened to other people.
So what do you do?
Well, someone suggested that what might need to happen here is a private plot is donated in a private way and the body is privately transferred.
Then the news media is going to camp out outside the uncle's house in Maryland until the uncle goes and visits the funeral plot.
Well,
and then you find out where it is.
We have a short attention span, Jim, and not a lot of money. Eventually, the news media will stop covering this. They're not going to spend, I don't think, weeks and weeks.
If you were
outside.
A town manager or a mayor of a community where that private plot was going to be, would you say yes to the
burial
there?
Well, I think it's privately done. It's a privately done deal.
It's within a city or town. I mean, you need a permit to bury someone, I assume, isn't it? I assume that's the law everywhere.
John Doe gets buried in the private plot, not one of the...
What do you think of this guy from Worcester's idea? Raise $5,000, send him home to Russia.
I think this guy from Worcester, when he says, I need help here, what am I going to do? I'm a funeral director. I got to bury this body.
No, I'm talking about the guy who's saying, I'm going to raise $5,000. I'm putting up $500 of my own money. It'll cost $5,000 to ship him home where his parents are.
Well, apparently it's unclear whether Russia will take him. That's a problem as well. So I don't know what's going to happen to this body. But obviously he does have to be buried, or there can be an Osama bin Laden-like burial at sea.
Well, it's a burial regardless.
I don't know who's going to do that.
877-301-8970. Is he entitled to a dignified burial, as both Reverend Eugene Rivers III said, and as Peter Stefan said, who's the head of the Worcester Funeral Home, where his body now lies?
Let's go to Tyler in Marion. Thank you for calling, Tyler. Hi.
Hi. I actually have two questions. One, burial being paid for the man in Worcester, he's willing to pay for this burial?
No.
He is not.
Oh, wait.
I think he said he was willing to pay
for the
burial.
Which one? The one who raised the $500?
Stefan.
No, he's not. I don't think he is. Is he?
I think he said that one of the earlier
stories. Oh, my apologies. If that's the case, my apologies. Marguerite sounds like she knows what she's talking about. So it's not a taxpayer thing. Is that where you were going?
No, I'm just wondering, because if it's not him, then where does the body go if they can't find somewhere to bury it? Because I imagine that they just can't have that guy sitting there for so long. I mean, sorry.
Well, I don't think he's sitting there, but I know what you mean.
Well,
you know,
by
the way, I think the uncle, if I recall correctly, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong, I think the uncle is of some means. I don't think he's wealthy. But you know what happened here? The wife had the right to the body. She waived it so that the uncle could go claim the body, and that's exactly what he has done.
And some relatives spent hours in there washing the body, according to Muslim custom.
Tyler, what do you think should happen?
I think they should definitely bury him. That's just disrespectful at this point. I understand what he did. It was very horrible, and, you know, he's already dead. I mean,
what if it was in a private plot? What if it was in a private plot in your hometown in Marion? Would you be okay with that?
If it wasn't marked, I mean, I don't want to, you know, media friendly there.
Yeah.
If it was the John Doe, like you said, if it was the John Doe privately done, a whole big about it with media and everything everywhere, you know. I think it could be done very courteous with all the
dignity. Yeah. Well, that's where you and Marjorie are. Tyler, thank you for a fine call. We appreciate it. And, you know, by the way, one of these articles mentions the fact that I think it was the uncle that said it was the FBI, or maybe it was Peter Stefan, the funeral guy, funeral home director, that the federal government had to get involved and do this thing. And then the FBI apparently said they're not sure they even have jurisdiction to take the body. So there are a whole ton of legal issues in addition to, as Gene Rivers said, some political issues as well.
Paul from Milton, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Paul, what do you think?
Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
Hey,
fine, thanks.
Good. There's a lot of wisdom in the phrase dead and buried.
Yeah.
You know, I sent you an email, I don't know if you got it, about the crazies that are popping up on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a shot-up picture of the United Nations symbol. And those are the people who are against his burial. I would like to see a clergy association of get together, Cardinal O'Malley, Jewish leaders, Muslim leaders, leaders from the various partisan denominations, and get together as one unit and either offer a plot in their cemeteries somewhere in Massachusetts. It will be a great learning lesson. What I'm afraid of is that this will make a martyr out of him, and that someone's going to come along now and try to revenge the fact that the Muslim burial process wasn't followed, and will try to seek havoc on the rest of us because it wasn't followed.
You know, by the way, your notion of an interfaith thing, even though, you know, on one level, following up just weeks on the heels of the interfaith service on the Thursday after the marathon bombing, it sort of strikes you in the wrong way when you think about it for a minute. That also provides cover in a lot of ways to insulate this from all the crazies who decided that their energy should be put in protesting this. Paul, it's an interesting thought, and thank you for the call.
You know, I'm a big government transparency person, yeah. But this is a case where I could see people not knowing. I think I'd be fine with people not knowing where he is.
How long do you think it would take for his burial place to be on the internet? Like 10 minutes? 20 minutes?
I don't know.
30 minutes?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, it would have to be shipped out among a lot of other bodies going off to their places of burial. I don't know how you do that. I mean, how many people does Stefan bury up there in Worcester? By the way, he did say he'd pay for it himself. It's
here's the quote, actually, right. Right. Exactly. My question is someone going to do something once I get him there? And he is willing. Yeah. You were right. He's willing to pay. Good for the. Yeah,
he sounds like a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
He just sounds like a wonderful guy, this funeral director up in Worcester. I don't know how he wound up getting chosen.
Well, because I think, if I recall correctly, and I was wrong about him willing to pay, so I may be wrong here as well, I think that no one wanted him, and no one wanted to be involved in the stuff that you're going to have to deal with.
So you wonder if the North Attleboro Funeral Home said, get him out of here?
Is that
it? Because he started out in North Attleboro, remember?
But
the news helicopters followed the hearse to the funeral home.
You know, by the way, the more I think, I don't know if you said this, Rivers said, whoever has been saying to prove that we are better than them.
Right.
I mean, the longer I think about this, the more I agree with the notion. I like Paul's idea of this interfaith group also deciding to do something here, because it shows, despite what he did, we are better, obviously, than these two mass killers. I like that notion.
James in Worcester. Thank you for calling, James. Oh, Jones.
Okay.
Is it Jones?
Jones.
Hi, Jones.
I'm sorry.
How are you?
I apologize.
It's all right, Margie. Well, my whole issue is this person committed a crime, as we say, but he was not brought through the court system where we could say this person was innocent or guilty. So that being said, he died in the course of being apprehended for his crime. Therefore, we cannot prove, yes, he did it or not through our judicial system. Him being dead, there shouldn't be any issue burying this man. He is dead. It's cut. It's simple. He's dead. Bury him according to his customs and move on. This man has taken money out of his own pocket to prep this body to be buried according to his custom, as any human should do, being that this is another person that died.
You mean Peter Stefan, you're talking about, the funeral home director there down in Worcester?
Yes, yeah. I am so proud of this man for stepping up and taking this body that nobody would, so he can prep him according to the customs of his religion, mm-hmm. to send him off into wherever the afterlife, whatever you want to call it. It is a great thing he's doing. Now, people in Worcester need to understand, this person died according to whatever he believed, doing whatever he wanted.
Well, Jones, you were with me for most of that conversation. No, he died attempting to kill police officers. That's why he's dead. Had he surrendered at some point, he'd be in a jail cell next to his brother. He's dead because he tried to kill people who were trying to protect all the rest of us. And while technically you're true, you're correct, obviously, he's alleged to have committed this. He did do it. And he also tried to kill the cops. But despite that, I'm still with you that you're right, that the reality is he's dead. And he's entitled to a burial, and we should move on. So, Jones, thanks for the call.
You know,
we appreciate it.
We have done this before. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald was a pretty hated person. And if you did have a cemetery where they were willing to patrol it for a while to make sure that people weren't going to go
in there.
That's
a good point.
And you don't know, and there are thousands of plots in there. And I suppose you could say, well, I mean, if you were going to be buried in the Muslim section of the cemetery, if you wanted to be buried among your fellow Muslims, I guess they could find it out. But if we could do it with Oswald, it seems to me we should be able to do it with this guy.
Yeah, but that was pre-internet, by the way. And that's the only the ability to communicate where he is and create an uproar. But you told me earlier today, and I forgot, while you said that Tim McVeigh was cremated, did you also tell me no one ever claimed the ashes and they just spread them? Wasn't it?
Both the bodies of Timothy McVeigh and the bodies of Ted Bundy were unclaimed after their executions.
And cremation, correct? Execution and cremation.
They were cremated and their ashes were spread. We don't know where they were spread.
So. And again, if you just tuned in, obviously you've learned this in the last couple of days, as have we, is that Muslim law does not allow him to be cremated, or else obviously that would be the resolution. They could cremate the body of the older brother and send it back to his parents or give it to his uncle. Let's take another one. Let's go to John in Holliston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Just a couple of things. First of all, the politicians are what's fueling this fire. Remember the Central Park Five? I just saw that documentary. And Giuliani was one. He was there at the time also.
This is the woman, for those who don't recall, this is the woman who was raped in Central Park while she was running, and that the guys who all convicted for this ultimately after a handful of years were
this was huge
found not to have done it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just the news media is on the thing just like they were then. But Giuliani was in that mix too, riding the coattails of this thing, the politicians. So I think they're flaming, you know, they're fanning the flames of this. And let me just say additionally that Stalin, who made Hitler look like a fairy tale, he killed more people than Hitler ever thought to in World War II, and he got a burial. So, you know what I mean? It's all hypocrisy.
John, thank you for the call.
You know, I don't know where he's buried.
Who?
Hitler. Do you know where he's buried?
I thought they weren't even sure where the body was.
Yeah, we should
have
looked that up, Jim.
Why don't you look it up right now?
I'll have the computer, Jim.
Maybe right after the show, I'll check it out.
I'll get
back to you. For your calls.
Okay. We are moving on from this subject to a fascinating subject, which has to do with terrorism, too. Did TV antiheroes like Tony Soprano, Breaking Bad's Walter White, and Homeland's Nick Brody trick us into thinking we understand real-life antiheroes like the alleged bombers in the Boston Marathon? A horrible tragedy? Well, that's a question our next guest, Joanna Weiss, raises in a piece she wrote for Slate. Joanna is also a columnist for the Boston Globe. Joanna's going to be with us in just a second.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. You know, Joanna Weiss is a columnist for the Boston Globe. That's by day. By night, she apparently writes for places like Slate.com. She wrote a great piece. It's called Breaking Bad, and the subheadline raises the question, have TV antiheroes like Walter White, that's from Breaking Bad, made us believe we can understand real-life villains like Jahar Tsarnaev? Here to answer the question, since she posed it, is Joanna Weiss. Nice to see you, Joanna.
Nice to see you, too.
Now, I'd like to say, for a woman with little kids, you're spending an awful lot of time watching these gruesome television shows.
Burning the haze, burning the midnight oil. You got your escape at night, your dark escape.
So what's your theory, Joanna?
Well, my theory is, you know, we've always wanted to, there's always been an interest in getting inside the mind of the killer, but what some of these real quality TV shows since The Sopranos have made us do was kind of expect or imagine this duality, you know, these two sides of the same person. So you've got the sociopath on one end, and then you've got the decent guy, Tony Soprano, loves his family, Dexter, nice to small children, you know?
Serial killer, for those who don't watch
the
show.
Dexter on Showtime.
Yeah.
So it really struck me in the days right after the marathon bombing, when it seemed like people just kind of instantly set up this narrative, right? Oh, clearly this guy, Jahar, was influenced by the older brother. People already had the framework in their heads. Why is that? I think we've been watching too much TV.
And your contention, your piece is fabulous,
by
the way.
It is a great piece.
You contend that people like Adam Lanza, for obviously Newtown, and Jared Loughner from Arizona, the reason they don't fall into that category, we're not that interested, is because most Americans are convinced convinced they're mentally ill. And they're not convinced that Jahar Tsarnaev is. So you write this. Here, let me read this line. There's another way TV has influenced our reaction to the Boston bombing, another screen impulse that's found its way into real life. It's the urge to see a perpetrator, in this case, 19-year-old Jahar Tsarnaev, as a person we can understand. So you actually think, and when I first read it, I said, no. But then I read it again, and I agree with you. It's because of these villains who we have attached ourselves to. Tony Soprano, Soprano's my favorite show of all time. Homeland, pretty close second. Because we've done that there in fiction, we're trying to do the exact same thing or apply the same standards in real life. That's where you're going.
I think so. And again, it's a tricky thing to bring up because understanding does not mean condoning, and it doesn't mean having sympathy for the guy. It doesn't, it doesn't mean that people aren't happy to see him incarcerated. But I do think people want to kind of put this framework on it. They want to get behind. They want to understand how this can happen, partly because they want to understand how it could be prevented. And here's this guy he's not just the weird kid with the briefcase that everyone knew was going to do something strange someday. He had friends and buddies, and he went to the prom, and he smoked pot with his pals, and the teachers liked him. I mean, he seemed like you're all around good kid.
Well, I think this is the distinction between having interest in this young guy, the younger brother there, Joe, and someone that seems like off the deep end like Loeffner is so true, because I think of the trials that I've covered in my life, murder trials, and there are some where the defendant is really crazy. It was like the ziti killer who allegedly killed his wife after she cooked the zitis wrong. That's what we called her in the Herald, the ziti killer.
What was he, Rosenberg? What was his name?
Rosenberg. Yeah. I forget. He drove around with the baby in the back of the car and it was bloody and he clearly had done it. Versus the first murder trial I ever covered, two good-looking, young, black teenagers from Roxbury who killed this nurse on Commonwealth Avenue. Deborah Smith, her name was. And I became transfixed by this trial because you saw these two young men. They were attractive. They seemed like regular kids. And you think, how did they get to the point where they could have committed this crime? And I became just totally wrapped up. And I felt embarrassed by it because I should have been more wrapped up by the life of the victim than I was by the life of the young man who allegedly killed her.
Well, I even thought about the Steubenville case where, which got a
yes,
lot of attention. Where,
the rape.
Again, you can sort of understand the culture maybe that leads to these kind of parties and this terrible thing. So these are the high school football players who were convicted of raping, a 16-year-old girl in Steubenville, Ohio.
And then videoing the thing.
No, it was a terrible, terrible crime. The two guys were convicted, but a lot of the media coverage right after, again, here were these two kind of all-American looking kids with a lot of promise, and they're going off to jail, and one of them just sobbed in the courtroom, and there was this feeling these promising lives have been altered, and there was this kind of wellspring of, I don't know what you want to call it, sympathy, empathy, understanding, confusion for how something like this could happen.
Yeah, 877-301-8970. We're talking to Joanna Weiss, columnist for the Boston Globe, wrote this great piece in Slate suggesting that essentially our obsession, and it's in my
fascination
case, with these TV Walter White types and Tony Sopranos essentially fueled this notion that we're now dying to find out what essentially got Jahar from where he was to where he is today. By the way, just the scene in Tony Soprano, this is what struck a nerve with me that I waited for every week, and it didn't come every week, is when he wasn't killing people, and when he wasn't abusing people, when he wasn't in bed with women 6 seconds before he went home to Edie Falco, one of the great actresses of all time. He was talking to his shrink. One of the great interactions ever. Here's Soprano with his shrink.
Obviously, I'm prone to depression. A certain bleak attitude about the world. But I know I can handle it. Your kids, though, you'd give anything in the world to trade places with them so they don't have to suffer.
You know, the horrible part of this, now this isn't where you're going, but when I used to watch Soprano there, I mean, I just, as I said, I loved it, never missed it, is you sort of said to yourself, which was the scary part, is I'm as little like him. I mean, I could be sitting with the shrink having a comparable conversation. And then you say to yourself, could I also be not doing something quite as horrible as he did. But is there something in me that would allow, I mean, that the connection you make to these people, and maybe that's what people are thinking about with this younger Tsarnaev, is when you hear all these things about him as a 16 and 17 year old, people say he was not unlike my 16 and 17 year old, right?
Right. Oh, and you also want to put yourself in the place of Zhahar's friends and the people who knew him. How did they not see that there was something else lurking and going on? I mean, we're all kind of implicated in some way.
Yeah. And you know what else is a great one, too? The O.J. Simpson trial. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were signs that O.J. Simpson had been a domestic abuser and they had to call the cops, and the cops were all getting the autographs of O.J. while his poor wife was cowering in the corner in her underwear. But to the outside and to most people who weren't intimate with O.J. Simpson, he was this charming, great athlete, funny guy.
He was loved in the Naked Gun movies, right?
Yeah, we all laughed at him and stuff. And you get fascinated with, again, how does someone get from A to Z? Mm-hmm. And I think that is, again...
Or how does someone have A and Z in him at the same exact
exactly.
time?
Exactly. Like the Tony Soprano thing that you just talked about.
Jonah Weiss, before we're going to get the calls in a minute at 877-301-8970. Where did this start? I mean, you pointed out what is obvious to the likes of you, who used to be a television critic and now do what you do. It wasn't obvious to me. When do we start seeing these shows where these men, I guess, do horrible, horrible things, but there's a softer side, or at least a softer place from which they came? Nick Brody on Homeland and Soprano and Walter White, and before he got cancer and started doing the meth lab.
Yeah, I don't know about
where
him.
Where was the first? We'll get to that in a second. What started all that?
I mean,
The Soprano?
Someone will have a disagreement with me, but I would say The Sopranos. I would say The Sopranos was what really sort of launched this cable prestige television trend, where you have these, you know, these series that are really deep and they're beautifully written and they're morally complex and they center on these antiheroes. And yeah, most of the time they're men. I mean, I guess you could say Weeds on Showtime was kind of the, you know, suburban mom who was the pot dealer.
Right.
So, you know, every once in a while there's a female character, but a lot of times these men fascinate characters, you know, people who and they're not exactly villains, because it's not like J.R. Ewing, who you love to hate. This is a guy
because there was no redeeming quality.
There was no redeeming, and he didn't want a redeeming quality. He was happy
right,
to
exactly.
be the evil guy, and he didn't. That was the joy of watching J.R. Ewing. He's just bad. These guys, they make it it's a little harder for the viewer to even kind of manage your emotions while you're watching these guys.
We're talking with Joanna Weiss, who wrote a great column for Slate magazine. She is a columnist for the Boston Globe too, but she wrote this piece for Slate about how our fascination with these television heroes, which sort of translates into our fascination with the alleged bombers. I was going to ask you, I can't be the only person who doesn't know about this guy, Walter White, on Breaking Bad. He's a mild-mannered teacher, then he becomes a villain. What happens?
Yeah, and I'm not as up to date on Breaking Bad as a lot of people. I know people who are just obsessed with the show.
Well,
and
the
I've got a little to catch up. But yeah, this is a guy who's a science teacher. Started out as a science teacher, gets a terminal that he thinks cancer diagnosis.
And he can't afford the stuff, mm-hmm. and he doesn't want to borrow. Even though his wife does, from his former colleague who's now an entrepreneur making $1 zillion. And so to give you the short version of this, he ends up doing manufacturing meth because he's a science genius with this young kid who used to be his student.
To make money?
To make money. And then it goes from this small side business to pay for his cancer treatments into this multi-million dollar thing in which he commits some of the most violent acts while he's trying to get back with his wife and his young kid. I mean, it's the soft side and this vicious, sort of valueless killers, killer in one case, at least side. So, yeah, by the way, it's great. You should see this.
Sounds
great.
Terrific.
Yeah. But you know what the fear is of this? The fear, I think, is it possible, if you're right, that the search for what happened to Zhahar is at least in part a product of our fictional search with the Walter Whites from Breaking Bad and the Tony Sopranos and the Nick Brodies from Homeland. Is it possible that that causes some people to not appreciate the horror of what happened because it's almost a movie to them too? Or is that not happening?
I don't know. I mean, I think people were mostly pretty horrified by the bombing.
No, I don't mean that. But I mean, this what's driven me nuts is this kid. I know it's a lit. This kid is a mass killer. I mean, he is a mask. He's not 14 years old. One of our callers said last week, don't call him a kid anymore. This young man is a mass killer. But at the same time, half of it is, let's figure out what happened to him so we can prevent it. Half of it is this sort of odd fascination that I think is bred of this fictional world in which many of us spend our nights and weekends and that sort of thing.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think of this theory? I think it's a fascinating one, that the villainous world on television, a lot of these great series everybody loves, has drawn us to be fascinated, by, if I'm getting your theory right, fascinated by these characters, and that translates into our fascination with some of the alleged, with the two of the alleged bombers, particularly the younger brother who was supposedly drawn into this by his big brother.
Do you say alleged because of your newspaper?
It's habit. I mean, habit. What do you say,
Joanne? You're a newspaper woman, too. Do you still say alleged?
I mean, in print, I do. I still say alleged. You know, I mean, yeah.
How about in the real world?
In regular conversation, I don't feel a lot of personal doubt, but I also do, you know, I have a lot of, I like the system we have where we still get to trial.
Who's going to sue us, Joanna?
Right.
I don't think, Tamerlan's not, obviously. I don't think Joe Haar is in position to sue us.
I'm just happy that we still, even so he gets alleged. I feel like that's
but
just,
one
that's
of them
a,
never does go to trial. That's the problem with the alleged problem. We had this caller before, Jones, remember from Worcester, who was talking about, you know, he never had his trial. It was never proven. It was never.
Here's how it'll work.
What's up?
After we convict Joe Haar,
then they're both.
Right.
Let's go to
Sarah Newton. You're on with Joanna Weiss from The Globe and this piece in Slate.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think there's a lot of virtual machismo, for lack of a better word, where you can just fire things off. The way that they acted, they dropped bombs and walked away. You have commentary all the time that is so vicious. And Marjorie, you could probably attest to this.
I can. Comments
to, you know, an article or something like that with, you know, art.com or something like that, where they don't have to actually say things to you. It's such a weird thing. It's a virtual life, and it's scary because you never know. You don't know who's behind the counter.
So what are you saying? Or, is this potential in everybody? Is that where you're going with this?
I do think that because I wouldn't think that, you know, reading, you know, the commentary in the Herald or the Globe or the New York Times, you would have people saying such vicious things, and you do have comments to just a column.
Yeah.
And you have people who are just like in the dark and in the shadows, and they're literally dropping bombs verbally or literally or physically leaving bombs.
Sarah, thanks for the
call. Sarah, that's a great point. You know, I'm inured to it after me, but when they went after my little 10-pound dog, in my Christmas Marley and Me, I wrote Peanut and Me, that's my dog's name, attacking my 10-pound defenseless dog. I thought that was one step
by the way, Joanna was shaking her head in recognition as you were, too,
Margaret. I've gotten the comments. You do. They just wash over you after a while. But I do think if you're not used to that experience, it really is stunning.
Yeah.
The families who, you know, get in the middle of a news story and then all of a sudden the comments, you know.
To the families. To victims of crime. It is unbelievable how vicious people get.
Oh, it's so hurtful.
You know, we mentioned that Nick Brody is an example that is used in this piece on Slate.com. And for those who don't watch Homeland, he's the suspected terrorist who's also a father and a husband. Here's his family enthusing over the possibility that Brody could be vice president of the United States. Nobody has any idea about his double life. Just listen.
The phone has been ringing all day. You would not believe it's coming out of the woodwork.
Guess how many friend requests I got today?
How many?
300.
That's a lot of friends.
My God, Brody. Vice president of the United States?
Let's not get carried away. Walton's just floating my name.
Still, just the fact that he's mentioning your name in public, that's pretty incredible.
Hey, you sure you want this?
I'd be lying if I said this hasn't been fun.
Well, there's a guy who we all know is a would-be terrorist, big time, who is totally in love with his kids, at least. The wife is an iffy kind of problem. No, but your point is so beautiful. And you watch that show, and everybody's trying to figure out, while we know what the act, we're not going to spoil it for anybody, what it was that happened that turned him from this patriotic military person.
They say it in the first episode, don't they?
Yeah, but a lot of people haven't seen the first episode. So it's there.
No, and I love Homeland. You know, one thing that I've always one thing that's always bugged me in the back of my mind about the show is that here's a guy who comes back, right? He was a POW in, I think, Afghanistan for, 7-8 years. And he comes back and everyone's like, oh, normal guy, no problem. Get right back in. Let's run him for office, you know? But maybe that's the whole point, is that people so want to believe that the guy, that
that somebody sort of fits that good mold and that hero mode, that you're willing to just kind of block out everything else that's troubling around the edges.
And you know what else I think is really scary about this whole situation with you know, the fictional stuff on television? The wife is clearly oblivious, mm-hmm. rather, in Homeland.
Sort of willfully.
And then you see this in real life where, you know, the spousal killings or the Carol DeMade Stewart is probably the classic example of all where, you know, she was murdered by her husband coming out of a birthing class. I mean, I don't know what she thought about their relationship. I don't think she had any inkling.
How about the Tsarnaevs' parents and aunt?
Yes.
With the exception of the uncle. I mean, they're totally buying into the fact these are great young men who were done wrong for whatever reason. Joanna Weiss, it's a fabulous piece. You can find it on Slate.com. Just type in Breaking Bad and Joanna Weiss, and you'll find it. Joanna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For being with us. And thanks to you guys for being with us today. You can find us on the web 24/7, wgbhnews.org/BPR. You can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, or me at Jim Browdy, or Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. We have a very user-friendly studio. It was made more user-friendly over the week by John Frank and Miles Smith. We could not be happier. It is spectacular. So thanks to both you guys. Tomorrow, we're going to continue our discussion about biking and driving and those sort of things. We're going to talk about whether or not there should be rules against distracted biking. Should you be able to text while biking? The answer is so obvious, it's ridiculous. But we'll fill in some blanks for you. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll be back bright and early at noon tomorrow. We hope you are too. Have a great day.